Today we're going to be talking about one of the topics that affects the greatest number of consumers and musicians directly, and that is the rise of music streaming services. The easy way to make sense of the audio streaming revolution is as simply another phase in mass reproduction and commodification of musical culture. Sheet music, phonographs, radio, LPs, TV, CDs, and now we have Spotify. However, I would argue that companies like Spotify and Apple have broken with that tradition of mass media technologies in fundamental ways. To the extent that I wonder if the category of mass media even applies to these services. After all, rather than offering any listener in any location to have an identical listening experience, which was the groundbreaking innovation of recorded music, now any person and any location can have an utterly unique and customizable audio feed. Rather than building the next generation of mass audiences, the consumption of entertainment in general is being fragmented. Now, are there still mass cultural phenomena that reach millions or even billions of individuals? Yes. But these new generations of pop stars are being minted in a radically new process, and one that can be honestly quite opaque. So let's overview for a moment how 20th century media really functioned, particularly in the music business. 20th century media was fundamentally one-directional. By flipping on your TV or radio, or going into a store to buy a record, you provide next to no data for the media-producing machine. All or nearly all the information in this exchange is flowing from a record label, studio, or production company to the consumer in the form of recorded albums, singles, advertisements, and more. It's a one-directional exchange of information. To the extent that consumers did provide feedback into this system, it was anonymized and also delayed in time. In other words, as a media executive in the 80s, you could tell what artists had sold well over the past quarter, but you had no insight into the preferences of a specific teenager in Philadelphia. In a strange way, this put artists themselves and active communities of music lovers in a more influential position. You see, there is one other way that music listeners could offer their feedback directly to artists. That's the oldest way in history. By coming to their shows and making noise. This type of engagement and feedback from listeners operated on a personal, local, and immediate basis. Any musician can tell you about the feeling of playing to an audience that is picking up what you're throwing down. Sometimes it only takes a few notes before the energy of the room noticeably shifts. A murmur, a whoop from the crowd, a head nodding, then another. Or, if you're the Beatles, 1,000 screaming teenagers drowning you out. This intuitive access to feel what people like is a privilege of performing musicians. And until recently, corporate America had no analytical tools or source of information that could remotely compare. Major labels have always tried to serve as gatekeepers of culture. But throughout the 20th century, there are numerous examples of grassroots movements, sounds, and styles exploding in popularity on the basis of, at heart, their live shows, their raucous energy, maybe only a handful of demos, bootlegs, and home recordings at first. Such is the power of communally experiencing and playing music. When punk, hardcore, hip-hop, and many more caught fire, they caught the major labels largely flat-footed and scrambling to commercialize and capitalize off these new styles. And by that point, there were already massive and quite religious followings for the style itself, built from the ground up and hashed out on small stages, on street corners, in backyards, and basement jam sessions. The basic formula of punk was not created by labels, it was created by artists and fans. But that power balance, that story, has been shifting. I don't have to explain the whole digital revolution to you, but now, say you're a musician. Spotify or Apple can actually tell how well your song is doing and possibly even why that's the case. Better than you can, here now speaking in New York City 2022. They can pluck nascent trends out of the cultural noise if machine learning models suggest there's an audience for a new genre playlist. Take Pandora's Music Genome Project, which assigns labels to hundreds of traits or aspects of a song, from the tempo to the mood to the existence of a spoken word intro or the use of soul samples. The labels used by all streaming services are similar and extend troublingly into measures of a user's similarity with other users. Meaning there's likely demographic profiling of some kind, helping determine what kind of music appears on your playlist. Just as the same factors are used to target advertisements on many platforms. But while we can consider ads cultural detritus or a necessary evil of the entertainment landscape, music speaks to the soul, or at least it can. It can give solace or joy or a reason to hope. It can burn with political fire and shock with vivid urgency. So how can these experiences be reduced to a number, a probability, an algorithm? And more importantly, how can we entrust a handful of billion and trillion dollar companies to pick and choose what music thrives and what music gets lost in the noise? Who listens to what? And who can make a living from their music and the distribution of their music? The streaming service's answer is virtually no one. It's the same old story from decades past when record labels tried to get Americans hooked onto two or three easily repeatable formulas. Certain chords, certain beat, certain subjects for the lyrics, and replicate those formulas endlessly for profit. Only this time, it just might work. The streaming giants are in the position to dominate a huge portion of the listening landscape, and particularly the listening landscape that's most accessible to everyday people and everyday budgets. Vinyl record collecting, as admirable as a hobby it may be, is a luxury practice. Meanwhile, musicians, already weakened financially by these developments, no longer can reliably perform live, or tour, or draw large audiences and build their fan base organically, or to access that incredibly rich experience of interacting with people face to face, building connections, tapping into emotions, exploding somehow and sending that energy out into a crowd that can then experience that release as well. And make no mistake, live music is truly under threat. Everyone from major orchestras, operas, festivals, stadiums, and beyond depends on the freedom of travel around the world. Meanwhile, local scenes everywhere are under threat from lockdowns and the well-intentioned caution of audiences. So what can we do? Support live music when it does come back. And look into alternatives to the streaming giants, such as SoundCloud and Bandcamp. The artist-owned Tidal also offers an alternative in the streaming landscape, where a greater fraction of royalties end up back in the artist's pocket. The key technology this week, and I do apologize if my passion for this subject has led me off on a couple of tangents along the way, But the key technology behind these streaming services is data. What is a given company doing with the data you are giving it? Just by interacting with its products. How can we give data back to the people and create communal experiences again? Fields of play where a musician could feel us listening and take us into the next era of musical innovation. That's all for today. This has been On Sound, Episode 2, The Streaming Giants. Stay tuned and let me know what technologies you'd like to hear me dig into next. This has been On Sound. I'm your host, Harrison Adams, and I also offer audio production services through Patter and Hum Studios. Follow us at Patter and Hum on Instagram or visit patterandhum.com. That's PATTERANDHUM. Get in touch. Bring us your projects. Patter and Hum is where small sounds make big waves.